You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about the full-on offensive against the Build Back Better Act going on right before our eyes. And it's in real subtle ways and in real obnoxious, right out, you know, kicking you in the nose kind of ways. But I saw Tom Cotton on one of the right-wing loony shows going on about how we've been in a pandemic for 2 years and how he doesn't remember inflation or supply chain shortages or labor problem. He doesn't remember anything, none of it. He said, you know, the first year of the Biden administration, you know, it's the first year of the pandemic. We didn't see any of these things. And he goes, what's changed? Well, Joe Biden, the Democrats, they took power in January. So all of these problems, began the second Joe Biden's hand touched the Bible. Then all the wheels fell off the bus. Then there was crisis. Then there was chaos. Then there was poverty and hunger and homelessness. All of those things just appeared. I sat there and I'm watching this and I had to go back and rewind it and go, hold on, did I hear what I thought I heard? We've had this pandemic for 2 years. I don't remember inflation or supply chain shortages or labor shortages that we've seen in the first year of the pandemic. What's changed? Joe Biden. Yeah, that's what's changed. Now, interestingly enough, all of us who lived through the pandemic, we remember the bread aisles being completely barren. We remember neighbors fighting over rolls of toilet paper in the supermarket. We remember nurses wearing trash bags. We remember stories of nurses and healthcare heroes having to use the same mask for weeks and just taking, you know, some hand sanitizer and wiping the inside in the hope that that was going to protect them. But no, we have not had any supply chain issues until Joe Biden. And you go, what exactly is he talking about? Is he stupid? No. Not stupid. Is he, you know, just living in an alternative universe? No, he knows what happened. This was well planned, well thought out. This is to get us to think that, you know what, maybe it's true. Maybe everything is Joe Biden's fault. Maybe all of the supply chain problems that we didn't really pay attention to last year or the year before or ever, now we know it's all Joe Biden's fault. Now, understand, we're going to hear a lot of this. There was a talk given by Louisiana Senator John Kennedy, who talked about, you know, Joe Biden, he's the reason Thanksgiving dinner is going to cost a whole lot more money. The turkey's up, the giblets are up, the cranberries up, everything's up. And it's all because of Joe Biden. Because Louisianans, they love their Christmas and they love their Thanksgiving. And Joe Biden's the reason that you're not going to have either. And I'm sitting there going, wait a second, how insane is this guy? And understand what this is about. This is about stopping the Build Back Better Act. Remember that. And you go, does John Kennedy, the senator from Louisiana and Tom Cotton from Arkansas live in a different universe? No. They know what's what. And what they want is they want us to get irrationally angry. They want us to be fuming at the mouth. So we're not paying attention to the fact that they did this. The last guy was the cause for most of this. All of this has been bad decision after bad decision by whom? Well, them. And this is not news. But Cotton doesn't want you thinking about that. Again, we got to be angry because, you know, the price of gas has gone up a little bit and the price of a turkey's gone up a touch. He wants you angry. So you don't realize, you know, who's screwed you over and just how bad we've been screwed over, you know, for years through bad conservative policy. Understand, trillions of dollars of wealth have been, quote, redistributed, stolen from working people across this country and used to create, and thank goodness we have them, the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. You know, our billionaires, they got to pack in an extra couple trillion dollars during the pandemic, and good for them. And yet, Tom Cotton, all he's concerned about, I don't remember inflation or labor shortages or supply chain shortages before. I just found out now. And as I said, this is about stopping the public investment that would come from the Build Back Better plan. And it's not just the Republicans who want to stop it. There's a couple of Democrats. It's a little bit bipartisan. So you got to understand what's going on in this country. The fighting that we're seeing is not as much right and left as they want us to believe. But the fact that it's up and down, it's the wealth class of this country that does not want to see that Build Back Better plan put into place. They don't want to see what's coming out of that because it means they're going to have to pay more taxes, and they don't want that. No. Can't possibly have that happen. And now you've got Joe Manchin coming out. And leave it to West Virginia Joe. He's now echoing the same kind of language. Well, maybe we should pause. You know, the inflation, the supply chain stuff. We should pause. And you go, well, what exactly are we going to pause? Because remember what it is that Biden's plan is trying to do. It's trying to help families. It's trying to make work life a little bit better. It's trying to help with childcare and universal pre-K and all kinds of things that have been, well, ignored for far too long. And you've got, you know, Joe, who has been the very moderate Democrat. Well, you know, it's not that we don't want those things. We should just do them differently. Meanwhile, American families are suffering. American families are struggling to make ends meet. And yeah, there are some concerns. And we deal with that with smart policy, which is why the moneyed interests are freaking out, which is why you've got the Cottons and the Kennedys and even the Manchin out there saying, no, we can't have this. Not now. Inflation's too high. We can't afford it. We're broke. We don't have the money to invest in the future of our kids and our country. No, don't have that. We don't have it. Can't afford it. Which is why this conservative group, and I love the name, man. I love conservative names. They are such great propagandists. The Coalition to Protect American Workers. Wow, who could be against that? The Coalition to Protect American Workers. And I'm sure they'll have some woman with a nice, sultry voice. The Coalition to Protect American Workers. And you can't possibly be against it because, oh my gosh, we're protecting American workers. And how are we going to do that? Well, the guy who's the head of the Coalition to Protect American Workers is none other than Mark Short. Mark, the former Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff, former Trump House Legislative Affairs Director, right there in the Trump wheelhouse, in the moneyed class wheelhouse, their organization, the Coalition to Protect American Workers. They're going to spend $800,000 over the next 2 weeks in West Virginia, which, you know, that's only $800,000. In West Virginia, that's a ton. They're going to carpet bomb West Virginia with you. No, you can't have what's in that Build Back Better. No. love Joe Manchin, because that $1.7 trillion that would help you, you know, get some help for your kids to get, you know, a head start in school and help families with childcare and help, you know, get the $250 a month into families' hands to make sure kids stay out of poverty. Can't have it. Can't afford it. We're broke. Because why? Well, because our millionaire and billionaire funders, they don't want to pay higher taxes. Because who funds the Coalition to Protect American Workers? Well, they're tied to none other than the Koch brother money. You know, the bastion of caring about small families and working class folks. Also, the Freedom Partners and Americans for Prosperity and Americans for Dogs and Puppies and Cats Sleeping Together. You know, such great propaganda names, such nice euphemistic names. Who could possibly be against Americans for Prosperity? Except what they are is they're, well, the people who brought us really bad policy that has put us in a lot of these situations. You know, the no rights at work people, the people who want to destroy your ability to join and form unions and bargain collectively for better wages, hours, conditions. You know, the people who want to make sure that there's a safety net under families' feet, you know, like paid family leave that would be in the Build Back Better plan for measly weeks. And you've got, well, can't have that. We'll just breed lazy people. And the people who were against unemployment insurance. Remember, you know, go back with me in the way, way, way back machine. Remember when the Republicans like Lindsey Graham were saying, you know, we can't possibly extend unemployment benefits. No, 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 no. Can't do that because they'll just be lazy workers and they won't come to work and it'll be all this stuff. Remember how crazy they were about that? How insane they were losing. They're literally losing their minds. We now find out... So Republican. Hypocrites. We now find out that you've got a number of officials around the country who are complaining about the vaccine mandates and complaining that companies are saying, hey, you know, we need you to get vaccinated, or you got to move along. You got to do something else. Or, you know, in the case of some relatives that I have, they've raised their health insurance premiums, you know, through the roof. Because guess what? And this is what I've been saying from the beginning. Capitalism will figure this out. Capitalism will figure out how we deal with the vaccine mandates. Government should stop because it's not going to happen. Capitalism will figure it out. The insurance companies will figure it out. And then people are going to look at their checks going, well, I got to pay, in the instance of my family, an extra $1,500 a year for my health insurance, because if I get COVID, if I get one of the variants, I'm going to cost the insurance company mega bucks. And they're planning for the risk that that's going to happen. Maybe I should get vaccinated because I don't want to be out another $1,500. I've been saying this from the beginning. This is the route that it goes. But I find it hysterical that the Republicans are courting all of the anti-vaxxers, all of these folks, you know, because they're going to give them unemployment insurance. Yeah. Remember, the people who said, no, we can't give people unemployment insurance, who lost their jobs through no fault of their own. Now they're saying, well, we're going to give the people who had a choice. They had the choice. They could have been vaccinated. They could have kept their jobs and this wouldn't have been a problem. But no, 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 no. This is a political issue. This isn't a sanity issue. It's a political issue. And, you know, Republicans see an opportunity. And the opportunity is more division, because they can't win with a united working class. So more ways to keep us sliced and diced and pitted against one another. More opportunities to pluck segments on their side. So they go, hey, you know, we care about you. Come and vote for us, even though all of their policies have been bad for working class folks. And then to turn and go, well, you know, we used to be, we were against it before we were for it. And then we were for it before we were against, and all over the place. And this is where the frustration comes in. This is where we have got to, as a working class in this country, have got to put aside the nonsense. It's not the person working next to you, the person that lives across the street, they're not generally the enemy. We've got to figure out how to get through this kind of rhetorical nonsense. You know, like Joe Biden caused the pandemic shortages. It's all his fault. And get to the real root. which it's not about the divisions. It's always been about the 1% versus everyone else. The wealth class of this country, they know amazingly how to divide us. And I go back to Jay Gould, the railroad magnate from 1880s, who said, I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. We're in a moment right now where he doesn't have to even, they don't even have to pay. We're doing it to ourselves. And I look at something like the Build Back Better plan, which is what all of this, again, comes back to, which is why the Cottons and the Kennedys and the Manchins are stopping this. The moneyed interests don't want it. They don't want universal pre-K for their kids because they don't want everyone to have an equal opportunity. They don't want child care subsidies for their workers because, hey, we want people desperate. They certainly don't want the child tax credit money going into families. They don't want to expand Medicare because, hey, that might help granny get a new hearing aid. Well, I think it should be expanded more. This is a start. And they certainly, certainly don't want paid family leave. Now, remember, understand, Tom Cotton, John Kennedy, the rest of the Republican folks, they're the party of family values. They care about your family. They care about your Thanksgiving. But they don't seem to care about your neighbors. And the weird part in all of this is, and I keep coming back to it, we keep being put into these situations where they're saying things and doing things specifically to enrage, to keep people irrational. And this has been, look, 30 years of right-wing hate grievance radio in the making. They have trained a generation to, when they bark out the latest attack, they foam at the mouth like Pavlovian dogs. That the second they say, you know, Joe Biden's name, that you immediately close your ears, close your mind, and foam at the mouth. And in that environment, nothing gets done. And nothing getting done benefits who? It benefits the wealth class of this country, because right now they have the best democracy money can buy. They are firmly in control, because understand, those things that I laid out that are in the Build Back Better plan, wildly popular. Wildly popular to help granny stay in her home. Wildly popular to get her hearing aids and even chompers and glasses. Wildly popular to get family leave so that if you have a child or if you get sick or if you have a loved one who's sick, you don't have to go broke to have to take care of them. Wildly popular. Once you strip back, who's doing it? Because understand, we live in a time right now. We live in a moment where the Republican Party will not give Joe Biden a win. No, can't have it. And somehow we've got to step back from that, find a touch of reality, and move in a direction that's going to unite we, the working class, and have a true coalition who cares about working class people. A true coalition to protect American workers, not some front group for the Koch brothers. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day the world lost the miner's angel, Mother Jones. She had crossed the country many times over, been involved in practically every strike that built the labor movement, stood with miners and steelworkers and mill children everywhere. Mother Jones had asked to be buried with the Verdin miners killed in the massacre of 1898 at Union Miners Cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois. Dozens of labor leaders, including AFL President William Green, attended her funeral in Maryland, where she had been living. Then AFL representatives, several Illinois miners, and others boarded the Baltimore and Ohio train to accompany her body to Mount Olive. Historian David Featherling describes the scene as her body arrived. A band played "Nearer My God to Thee" as onlookers bowed their heads and wept.
Survivors of the Verdun riot bore the casket to the Odd Fellows Hall, where it lay in state. The town of 3500, with its strong and violent heritage, was thronged by thousands of coal diggers. At least 15,000 turned out for the funeral. Broadcast on WCFL, the Chicago Federation of Labor's radio station, the labor priest, Reverend John McGuire, gave the memorial address and officiated at the funeral in Mount Olive's Roman Catholic Church of the Ascension. He asked what weapons she had to fight the fight against oppression of working men. Only the great and burning conviction that oppression must end. Only an eloquent and flaming tongue that won men to her cause. Only a mother's heart torn by the suffering of the poor. Only a towering courage that made her carry on in the face of insuperable odds. Only a consuming love for the poor.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I talked about in the last segment, the reality is, you know, I watched that 15-minute, well, talk of Louisiana Senator John Kennedy's rambling about supply chain blame. You know, playing the blame game, it's all Biden's fault, all of it. And, you know, it just happened. It's all his fault. And the reason that Thanksgiving is more expensive, it's Joe Biden's fault. And in Louisiana, they love Christmas and Thanksgiving. And anyone who supports Joe Biden evidently doesn't, which is just the weirdest position. I'll tell you, I wish he'd have spent as much time talking about spending orgies talking about spending orgies as he would to actually fix some of our supply chain problems. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what's going on with our supply chain and maybe how do we fix things and how do we get things done? I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president for the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, I'll make time for you anytime. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I appreciate it. Now, I'm looking at, you know, where we are, and we've been hearing a lot of this talk about the supply chains. You know, Tom Cotton saying he doesn't ever remember there being any shortages. I guess he forgot people fighting over toilet paper in the supermarket in 2020. But, you know, hey, you got John Kennedy, you know, the price of a turkey's going up, so Thanksgiving's ruined because of Joe Biden. All of this nonsense, all to stop what I believe the Build Back Better Act would make better.
Yeah, it's they're trying to make political hay out of something that is not partisan. And I think that's the important thing to understand. Joe Biden didn't take any actions that put us into a position to have supply chain disruptions. In fact, I know from talking to the administration and talking to leaders that they're intent on trying to improve it, not only now, but permanent changes. And I think that's the important thing is that, look, yeah, you're going to get some shortages when there's panic buying, right? I mean, that happens a lot. And that's not really a partisan thing at all. And we did see that. We saw that during the Trump administration at the onset of COVID. So Tom Cotton has a horrible memory.
No, I don't believe he's got a horrible memory. I believe he's a good propagandist.
Selective memory, maybe. Yeah, exactly. And so, but the issue, and I think this is important because we've been talking about this, others have been talking about this, is that, you know, the kind of like deregulatory free market environment that free trade that most Republicans and unfortunately some National Democrats have promoted kind of got us where we are. We hyper-globalized, put way too much of our supply chains literally an ocean away.
Yep.
And you can't be nimble, you can't be quick, you can't jump over a candlestick if your stuff is stuck in a port and is going to take, you know, 6 weeks to get over here and then you know have to unload it. So you the way to deal with this after we get through this kind of like whipsaw back and forth is to shorten our supply chains.
Yep.
And that means bringing manufacturing back to the United States of America. Because yes, we may have some natural disasters here. We may have some supply chain disruptions here in the future. I'm sure that we will at some point in time. but they are a heck of a lot easier to fix when it's next door rather than when it's a world away, which is the situation right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you listen to, you know, the senator from Louisiana, you listen to, you know, people like Cotton, and they want you to believe that these supply chain issues are, well, just started the day that Joe Biden put his hand on the Bible. And the reality is we've had these problems, not to the magnitude that we have now, because we shut the country down for a bit. There's a lot of backlog that has to get through the system. And I think a lot of, you know, good old fashioned capitalism, opportunism, and, you know, people gouging where they can. But it's going to take time to unravel that backup. This is predictable, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the other important thing, and again, this is a transitory thing, but I think this is important, is that, you know, Tom Cotton, John Kennedy, what they're also saying is that, you know, their consumers are buying more than they had been, certainly more than they had been, you know, over the last 18 months. Okay. You know, they have more income that's coming in. Wages are going up. They have more disposable income. People are not traveling as much. They're not spending as much on services. They are purchasing more goods. That creates more demand for goods. Ultimately, that's a very good thing, and this will balance out. And I'm sure that if people weren't buying goods and these factories were going out of business and the stores were overstuffed, that they would have complaints too. So my goal is not to satisfy Tom Cotton or John Kennedy. It's to make sure that we have supply chains, manufacturing that works for customers, that works for consumers. And the way you do that is you have more of your supply chain in the United States of America than you used to.
Yeah.
That's the way to make sure that everybody is benefiting from the economic circumstances.
Now, for me, I look at this, Scott, as a moment where we can undo some of the horrible of the past decades. We can reshore our supply chain. We can build a more prosperous working class for people with good union jobs. There's a lot that we can redo and rebuild in a way that's going to make us more competitive globally and more secure globally. I mean, if you're looking at our supply chains and you're looking at the things that are going on, you go back during the heart of the pandemic, there were nurses wearing garbage bags, wearing the same masks for weeks on end. This is not a healthy, functional system.
No, no, it's not. And those are necessary goods. And when push came to shove, what happened? American producers, they transitioned and they made PPE and they helped get out of that shortfall. But what we see today still coming from online retailers like Amazon is a whole bunch of fake respirators, KN95s, that are being sold that are sourced from China. And that's, you know, and they're like catnip. I mean, the stuff is like, wow, I can get one of those for a couple pennies. I'm going to jump at that. And without even thinking, Wait, does this seem too good to be true? Yeah, it kind of does. And it becomes a public health menace because if they don't work, if they're not providing the protection that they're supposed to, they're putting people at risk.
Yep.
Meanwhile, you know, if Amazon, Walmart, others would give the time of day to American manufacturers, it would be a better situation. But guess what? They make better margins off of the products in China. So they're going to source those, even though it comes at great risk to a number of other things that we hold very near and dear to us and that we depend on.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, if we could figure out how to do this, maybe the tensions with China would change a little bit. I'm not really sure. I mean, we're in this moment where they are our supplier. And we've allowed that to happen through decades of, well, two decades of, here, you make it cheap. We'll be able to sell it back to those U.S. consumers and our billionaire class. Well, they're going to get fat and happy off of it.
Yeah, exactly two decades. You know, next month, 20 years ago, China entered the World Trade Organization and got extraordinary trade benefits from that, extraordinary investment from that. The expectation from everybody, and I know you remember this because I certainly do as well, you know, what Bill Clinton and everybody else were claiming is that this would usher in a new era of prosperity for the United States and for China, would help China to democratize, it would bring it into the community of nations, make it much more responsible. Obviously, none of that has happened. And part of it was a flawed strategy to begin with. Part of it was just a lot of neglect on the part of our national leaders for a couple of decades. And there's no president, I think, who's gotten China right. And so I do think that it's going to be one of the huge challenges that President Biden faces moving ahead. And I think he's right to be very clear-eyed about it. He's not wild like Trump was, and he's not just eager to make a deal for the sake of making a deal on trade, a terrible deal like Trump was. But at the same time, he's not reflexively philosophical on this, like I think Obama was, or Bush or Clinton. And so I do think that there's some hope that we can get this right. And just like, you know, there was a herd mentality about all these retailers, all these manufacturers headed to China to take advantage of this. You know, I'm hoping there's another herd that starts bringing this stuff back and realizes you can mitigate risks. And plus, when there's going to be more attention paid to carbon and climate, when there's more focus placed on the welfare of workers, when there's more focus placed on resiliency and mitigating risks, whether they're political risks or the risks that come from natural disasters or climate change, then sourcing from America makes a heck of a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And my hope is that MBAs start to understand that rather than just saying, you know what, we got to send all of our work to China. My hope is that that day has passed. There's lots of evidence that it should have passed a long time ago. But we still have a lot of work to do. And I want to be clear about this. It's not that I am anti-China in any way, and certainly not anti-Chinese people. But I do think we have to understand that the Chinese government is not friendly towards us at all. It's not friendly towards democratic norms at all. And so we can't pretend like more trade is going to make that better.
Right. No, we've tried it. We've virtually given them all of our manufacturing, and they want more, and it's not going to stop, and it's never going to end until, well, they're the dominant force on this globe. And they've already said that. They're not shy about it. And they're becoming more muscular militarily. They see themselves as the future of this globe. And that's a scary proposition, especially you look at some of the surveillance tactics and the things that they do. It's frustrating to me. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Scott Paul. Scott Paul is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is their website. You got a question, comment, thought for Scott, give us a call, 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. You know, you talk about this kind of manufacturing, bringing jobs back, bringing manufacturing back, reshoring our supply chains. This should be something that unites us as a country. This should be something that brings us together. Yet I look at what's going on politically, and we've never been more divided. This seems like it would be the perfect thing to go, yeah, we all want it. How come we can't do it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think part of it is unfortunately partisan politics. It has little to do with the policy of it. I will say that I'm hopeful because one of the rare pieces of bipartisan legislation that's passed this year was a competitiveness bill in the Senate that was designed to essentially tackle some of the challenges that we face with respect to China. Not a perfect bill, but it was progress. And I know the House of Representatives is going to start working on something as well. And so I do think that, you know, unlike, you know, 20 years ago, Rick, when it was fashionable for national Democrats and Republicans just to be pro open markets with China, because it's going to lead to whatever change that you can imagine. I think now, people in both parties are much more circumspect about this, but they have to have the will to come together. Infrastructure is a good example of where that actually happened.
Yeah.
And so, I don't expect a resounding majority for something, but I do think that there's enough who value wanting to bring semiconductor production back or wanting to make sure that as we transition to other fuels, that the manufacturing is occurring in the United States, and that we're not dependent on China for some of that, and that we're avoiding sourcing from regions where China is practicing genocide on its own people. So I think those are kind of a fundamental framework of where we can go. But yeah, I don't expect anything as big as Build Back Better or the infrastructure bill to get done on this. I think you're right.
And again, it comes back to, you know, we're pitted against each other, right, left, Democrat, Republican, you know, white collar, blue collar, green collar, ring around the collar. We're sliced and diced, when the reality is our division is the wealth class that controls all of our production and all of that. And then the rest of us who are left fighting for the crumbs. And it's frustrating. A moment ago, you said that you're not against the Chinese people or the country of China, which nobody, I don't think anybody should be. It is the communist government. And, you know, there was a story, you know, that caught my attention just the other day. I think it was a ProPublica piece about how China, you know, their surveillance state is not just in their country, but, you know, spans the globe and, you know, right here on our college campuses. And this is, again, you know, how much power and control, and if this is the world we want to live in, because I keep asking that question, where we're going, is this what we want to leave to our kids? And the answer to me is no.
This is crazy, and it's worth our readers finding this or your listeners finding this story, because it is unbelievable. And I will say again, I think this is something that's very good, having Chinese students and foreign students come to our universities. Our universities are a magnet for global talent, and they can build bridges of understanding, of academic collaboration. I think all of that is very good, and it should be encouraged. I think the challenge has been that as some of these Chinese students have been speaking out, whether it's about the situation with respect to Uyghurs or Hong Kong or other issues, the long arm of the Chinese Communist Party has come into the universities and has pulled them back. And they're being harassed, their families back home are being harassed. In some cases, students loyal to the Chinese Communist Party are disrupting these activities on American campuses. And unfortunately, and one analyst said this, the Chinese Communist Party is literally paying no price for this. Yeah. Universities are not standing up to them at all, are not protecting the students or their freedom of expression. And so I get that China wants to have rules within its own borders. I don't agree with them, and I certainly think we need to object to genocide and other things that are intolerable. But the long arm of the Chinese Communist Party shouldn't be allowed to reach into the United States of America and impact the right to free expression here in the United States. But that is what's happening, and our university presidents need to speak up.
I mean, that's insane. And when I'm reading this story, I'm going, you know, an extent. It's one of those things. Well, hey, you speak out, you might have to worry about what's going on with mom and dad. And that's not the message I think we want to be sending. And it's not. I think we have to stand up to that kind of stuff.
And it's all over the place. It's like at Purdue University, Georgia, at Brandeis, lots of different places. And it is just systematic. I mean, it's like the police state come to American campuses.
Yeah, it's crazy. Scott, I appreciate the time. Always great stuff. Keep up the great work. Thanks so much.
Rick, always great to be with you. Thanks so much. Have a great night.
Good stuff. Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1854. That was the day that Mary McDowell, known as the Angel of the Chicago Stockyards, was born. Mary's father brought the family to Chicago from Cincinnati after the Civil War. Her family was friends with U.S. President Rutherford B. Hayes, and as a young woman, she spent a month in the White House as a guest. Mary received her college degree and worked as a teacher for a wealthy family in New York. But living and working among the wealthy was not to be the course of her life. She returned to Chicago and became a kindergarten teacher at the famed Hull House. She then became the head of the University of Chicago Settlement House in the back of the yards. The Settlement House served the diverse neighborhoods around the Chicago stockyards. The community center included a library, play lots, gymnasiums, and classrooms. Mary and her settlement house supported the rights of workers to form unions and to have safe working conditions. In 1903, Mary became the head of the Illinois chapter of the National Women's Trade Union League. The Pittsburgh Press reported on an incident that captured the spirit of Mary McDowell. The city of Chicago had a practice of using garbage to fill holes in the streets surrounding the stockyards. Mary showed up at the mayor's office with a group of women from the neighborhood and demanded, quote, "All right, we want the rest of it dumped on Lakeshore Drive. If it's good enough for the stockyards, it's good enough for the drive, too." As a result, the city stopped using garbage to repair the streets.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
866-416-RICK. That's 866-416-7425. You got a thought, question, comment, something on your mind, we want to hear it. Because the question is, how's inflation, how's the supply chain disruption affected your lives? You know, I've been asking this question of people for a while, going, you know, okay, we hear a lot about it. How is it really affecting average, everyday working people? And the reality is, some of the responses I've seen is, you know, hey, we're staying home, we're doing different things, we're not buying as much because we're trying to save. What the pandemic showed us is how vulnerable we've become. And look, I've had a bunch of people say wages have gone up, so I don't really notice the inflation that they're talking about. We're paying more in dollars, but you know, I'm making more, so our standard of living hasn't really taken a hit. In fact, I've had some people tell me that, hey, things are better than they were before. And this is the weird thing. As our economy changes, and this is the moment that we're in, the economy is changing. And I would argue if we do the right things, if we make the right choices now out of this crisis, things can be better. If we reshore our manufacturing and we create good family-sustaining union jobs right here at home, and produce good quality goods that are competitive around the world, like we used to. Understand, I know, I think back to my grandparents' generation. You know, they were able to do all these things. They were able to have domestic production for domestic consumption. And this is what I've been saying for the longest time, this idea that we were sold as kids, in college, taking Econ 101 about rice and beans. You know, the country has the comparative advantage, they should do all of it. The country has this, and then we'll all be better off. The problem is, all of us aren't as benevolent as the producers of the rice and the beans. You end up with a China who is going to dominate with this mercantilist mentality, and they're not shy about it. Their roadmaps and their China 2025 plan, very, very upfront, very bold. They are going to dominate the next generation of manufacturing, the next generation of technology. They are going to do that. And we have CEOs in this country who, well, you know, we got shareholders to make happy. We've got dividends to pocket. We've got shareholder prices to get up so we can buy back our shares and cash in when we sell our stock options. We're worried about the next quarter. China's thinking about the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. We're worried about 3 months from now if we can make the shareholders happy. Not much concern about the working people. Not too much concern about the poor and the downtrodden. No, but we're still a Christian nation, is what they tell us. So I'm curious, you know, how are the supply chain issues? Are you going to the stores and not seeing toilet paper on the shelves? Is there bread? Is there milk in the stores? Are things there? Because, you know, unlike Tom Cotton, I do remember those moments at the grocery store where there was nothing there. You want to talk about a supply chain issue? Yeah, that was it. And people had to risk their lives and we called them essential. We called them heroes and patriotic. And now we're just dumping all over them. It's a shame. On Monday, you had Joe Biden meet with a bunch of CEOs to talk about supply chain issues. And I do find it interesting that some of the comments coming out of that meeting, for instance, the comment from the CEO of Walmart, Doug McMillan, or McMillian, he said that, you know, a lot of things are improving. You know, things are good. You know, we're doing all right. Stores are, your shelves are stocked. You go to Home Depot, it's packed. And yet, good for the president, not buying it. Not buying this, because understand, at the end of the day, what they want stopped is any investment in holding them accountable and regulating some of this stuff and going back and looking at, hey, why is this stuff broken? Now, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, you know, while you've got these CEOs meeting with the president, they're requesting information from those executives on, well, you know, how they're dealing with the quote unquote shortages. And are they gouging? Because I've said from the beginning, yeah, some of our problems are, yeah, the ports are backed up. Not just here in the U.S., but in China and elsewhere. So you've got the break point, the bottleneck point of the ports, getting the products onto the ships, and then the ships sailing across the water and being unloaded at the next port. You've got those two bottleneck points. And then once you get them off, where do you go with them? Because you can take them off a whole lot faster than you can put them on trucks and get them out. And then when you're bringing empties in, there's a whole backlog in this. So when you flip the switch off and shut all this stuff down, you don't just get to flip it right back on and it work perfectly again. There's going to be a backlog and there's an opportunity. We're hearing a lot now that shippers are going, well, there's premium space now, is where things were like $5,000 for space in a container. It's not like $20,000. There's a lot of these moments where you go, good old fashioned American capitalism, taking advantage of an opportunity to put more money in your pocket. Because this is what unregulated capitalism will get you. Now, the hope is, and as I've been saying for the longest time, I'm a big fan of reshoring our manufacturing. I'm a big fan of bringing back all those jobs. And the part that I struggle with, as I think most people do, is all of those companies that ran to China for the cheap labor and the lax environmental regulations, you know, the heroin that CEOs need. We funded all that. They got to write all that off on their taxes. We ended up paying for all of it. And we're going to end up having to pay for it coming back. Which for me then goes, yeah, I'm okay with it as long as we're getting something out of it. And this is where I come back to these jobs that will be created. They better damn well be good family sustaining jobs like they were when they left. You stop and you look around this country, every small town that's now a hollow shell of itself because the one factory left or the one main employer left for greener pastures in red China. You got to make those communities whole and you've got to help them. Because we're in this weird moment. We're in this weird moment where I think, again, as I started with, if we do things right, if we make the right choices, and this is where I'm guardedly optimistic that it's possible to unite this country around an idea. And that idea is we all need jobs and we all need good jobs. And if we are able to bring back manufacturing and that manufacturing pride that, you know, I think back to my grandparents' generation, that, you know, the job that you may be saving may be your own kind of mentality, that they all understood that their lives were interconnected. As consumers, they were helping their neighbors. We're not doing that anymore. We're just making a CEO rich and we're exploiting workers in another country. And I know my conservative friends will say, no, Rick, you know, the Chinese poverty rate has gone down. We're making lives better there. And to a degree, they are. But not to the extent that they're making, well, everybody else worse off. So opportunity here. And I think a good opportunity. But it comes back to, you know, how do we get over the obstacles? How do we get past the Tom Cottons and the John Kennedys who are, they claim they care about American workers. In fact, the Republican Party right now, and you got to give them some credit because they're reading the tea leaves right. They're trying to make a play for working class people. They really are. Their rhetoric is turned around. They're trying to make a play for workers because this mandate has split the working class of this country. Most people they've protected themselves, as you should. But it's a dividing thing. And Republicans are trying to take advantage of it because they don't care whether you're healthy or not. They don't care whether your family does well or not. It's purely politics. And this is what you see coming out of the Cottons and the rest of them. The question is, will we allow ourselves to be that kind of divided? And again, I come back. This issue, trade, should be something that unites us. It was a failed experiment. You know, I remember back in 96 when NAFTA passed, and I remember when we allowed China to have permanent normal trade relations. And I remember all of those things that put us on the path to where we are now. And look, there were people back then saying, this is where we're going to end up because you're going to have manufacturers fleeing the country for cheap and exploitable labor. And it's exactly what they did. And there was no accountability. Now is the time, in this crisis, in this moment, to be able to undo some of that. And I've been saying, you know, what Biden is doing is kind of a 45-year reset. Trying to put a social safety net back underneath people's feet, trying to get some direction in manufacturing and some direction in our supply chain and to help families. You know, at the end of the day, the people who tell us that they're the party of family values, not so much. I guess you have to ask which families. Is it the Walton family? Or is it the Ramirez family or the Smith family or the Jones family? More than likely, it's the Walton family. More than likely, it's the wealthy in this country. Look, there's a full-on press right now. At every turn, you see Walmart advertising how wonderful they're making their employees' lives. Nobody does it better than Amazon. Every time I turn around, there's an Amazon ad on Axios or in other places saying just how wonderful they are. And yet, you know, as we found out yesterday, a company that did every possible thing to break the law to deny their workers, the ability to join and form a union. And you go, but no, Rick, they were just making their case. No, they weren't making their case. They were intimidating people. They were threatening people. And the kind of surveillance state stuff that we were just talking about in China is exactly what they do at Amazon. I had a guy tell me that is this the kind of country you want in the future? If you don't touch something in 5 minutes and you don't scan something in 5 minutes, you can be fired via text. They just send you a little text on your little handheld thing, go home. You're fired. They don't even have people do it anymore. This is the brave new world. Is it the kind of place we want to live? And the workers at that facility said, no, we want to be able to join and form a union. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because I would argue nobody who signed a union vote authorization card is probably there anymore. And this is another example of a bad actor being, well, rewarded for being a bad actor. But something has to happen. And my hope and thoughts go out to the workers there at that Amazon plant in Bessemer, Alabama. Also, quick shout out to the Kellogg's workers in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Nebraska, and Memphis, Tennessee. It's been, I guess, almost 2 months now that the Kellogg's workers have been on strike. Evidently, they haven't talked since, I think, November 11th, when Kellogg said, this is the best offer you're getting from us. And now they're talking about permanently replacing those workers. And all the workers are saying is, look, we don't want a two-tier wage system. We don't want our union divided. We want to get rid of this. It's been horrible. You can't keep people People want to have full-time jobs that pay the same wages as everybody else. We want better scheduling. We want, you know, basically dignity, basically respect. And that two-tier wage system is one of the big slaps in the face. And, you know, I guess they're going to start talking again here this week. They haven't talked since November 11th. But I found it interesting what the AFL-CIO in Michigan put out, the statement they put out there. They pointed out that the CEO of Kellogg, this Steve Cahalane, evidently their numbers, their math, said that he can afford to buy Thanksgiving dinner for all 31,000 employees at Kellogg's for the next 7 years on 1 year of his salary. They say that he's paid more than 279 times more than median work wage of the workers at Kellogg. His $11.6 million compared to the 41,000 median wage of the workforce, 279 times. Does he do 279 times of the work? Is he shoveling 279 boxes of cereal per one? No, he's moving money from one pocket to the other and ensuring that the shareholders are taken care of. This is going to be an interesting week for this because, look, you know, this is, you start going this far down, they start threatening to do permanent replacements. It tells me that our labor law is completely broken and we need massive comprehensive reform. We need to be moving in a direction. This is something Biden's talked about. If we could get the Build Back Better plan pushed through, at least there would be some penalties, some very small ones, but there would be something. But there's got to be something in here to fix these contract disputes like this. There's got to be a way to get to a table and force negotiations without giving the employer the ultimate ability to fire everybody in the unit. That's not how this is supposed to work. But 70 years of ossificated labor law, this is what it's gotten us. And for me, this strike is kind of a real important one, because if they're able to get rid of all those 1,400 workers and replace them permanently, that's going to send a horrible message. And it'll be interesting to see what the Biden administration does if they do try to permanently replace them. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. How will the community react? I know in Chicago, when they closed up the Nabisco plant and moved it to Mexico, there was a huge hue and cry. But eventually it died down because people have lives and they had to get back to them. This is a moment where we need strong labor laws, where we don't lose and then fight our way back. Where you don't get fired and lose your job and hope that a system is going to help you. We've got to make sure that they don't get to fire you from the beginning. So I'm going to watch this closely. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, though. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Again, this and many other ones. You know, what's going on up in Buffalo at the Starbucks, those three locations up there. Lots on the labor front. Love to hear your thoughts. rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Senator Doug Jones is going to be here to share some thoughts on, well, where we are, where we're going, and what we need to be doing to turn the country around and forward. Back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day the British House of Lords rejected the People's Budget. The proposed budget plan was a product of the Liberal government headed by Prime Minister H.H. Asquith. This budget was championed by the Chancellor of Exchequer, David Lloyd George, and the President of the Board of Trade, a young Winston Churchill. The goal of the budget was to shift more of the tax burden to the wealthy. Lloyd George introduced the budget to Parliament. He praised the budget, declaring, "This is a war budget. It is for raising money to wage implacable warfare against poverty and squalidness." The budget included tax increases for higher incomes to fund welfare reforms. The budget also called for a rise in the inheritance tax. These increases were relatively modest. The most controversial aspect of the people's budget was a hike on taxes on land sales. This would have had an impact on large landowners. Since many conservatives were large landowners, they opposed the budget. The House of Lords was allowed to reject the budget but could not amend a money bill. They had not rejected a budget for more than two centuries. King Edward VII privately urged that the budget be passed to avoid a crisis. The public clamored for the passage of the budget plan, but the House of Lords vetoed it. The House of Lords eventually capitulated and passed the budget the following April. Resistance to a progressive income tax structure and raising the tax rates on the wealthy is not unique to the British Parliament. Similar tax proposals have been offered in the United States and have been met with stiff opposition from conservatives in our Congress. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.